It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Alice Walker and John Updike are among the dozens of renowned authors who have spoken about their writing with Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures. Let's talk about the new season of the 10 Evenings series with Executive Director Stephanie Flom. Stephanie, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
So Stephanie, could you give us some of the highlights in your mind of this season? Who are you anticipating the most?
Oh gosh, I can never answer that question. Authors are always asked, especially by children, to name their favorite book. And they'll often say that's like a favorite child. Mm-hmm. But different people for different reasons. You know, I love a good story and a good epic saga. We've got one with Washington Black. We've got one with Richard Powers. We can turn to mythology with Madeline Miller and her modern-day feminist take on the Odyssey. And then at the same time, there's literary fiction. So the book about grief, Sigrid Nunez, is just so beautifully written and hard to read, but draws you in. There's a moment when she is reading letters to a young poet, to the Great Dane. They will just be with me forever. At the same time, the nonfiction is just so important. And someone like Ibram X. Kendi, whose book has just launched to great acclaim, and he's really become a voice for us to listen to about his important topic of anti-racism.
Right. And very topical, very timely right now, his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're very proud to be presenting him and know that's going to have a big impact on our community. At the same time, we love having the iconic longtime writers like Doris Kearns Goodwin, and then the new names like Carmen Maria Machado. So all to say, I can't pick a favorite.
Of course, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the presidential historian, I
guess. Yes. And oh gosh, so smart and tells those stories with no notes. She just, you know, they're like her friends. She's known them all her life, and she can just pop up facts and figures about these astonishing people. And inspiring, of course.
You've highlighted this season, 10 Evenings. How's it differ, would you say, from last year?
Last year, I would say there were four names that were in that newer, lesser-known category. Mm-hmm. And the audience was so responsive, and we heard again and again, both by people telling us and in our mid-year survey, that they really appreciate being introduced to authors that they don't know. So that gave me more confidence that is a big part of who we are, is to introduce new voices, and that people are curious, and people are also happy to read outside their genre or learn about books they didn't know. This year, there are a few of those, but I'd say a few lesser. It just all sometimes is the gestalt of the curation process.
All right. How do you decide that this person fits into this group? Do you select them individually, or do you have the whole season in mind?
It starts with a one-by-one process. So I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of reading of books. I do a lot of reading about books. I read a lot of reviews. I listen to radio interviews. And usually one or two might pop up early in the process. So as soon as I clinch last season, which is late last winter, I'm looking for next season.
Do you read them all?
I read them all. So I read everyone. If the new book isn't out yet, then I will read backlist before I invite them. So I read them before I invite them. But what I especially have learned to love is the reread. So I've never been a rereader, but I reread them right before they come, and I love that. You just hear and see and envision different things when you get to read it again. You're less concerned about the plot and can get lost in other parts, either characters or the words. And, you know, we'll get to learn something about them as people as well as their creative process.
It's the Confluence. We're talking to Stephanie Flom from Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures. Do you look for a mix of issues that the authors address in their works? And if so, is there a right mix?
So absolutely. So those early process, those names start to go on my grid. It becomes a puzzle. And then I want to make sure that there is a mix of fiction and nonfiction and gender and race and ethnic background and ages. That's become an important part for us, so that we want to have that aspiring new author in their 30s as well as a legacy author in their 70s or 80s. So, but to mix it up and to make sure there is a nice balance of topics and styles as well as the personalities of the authors and their backgrounds and also the issues that they are addressing.
Mention the timely issues. Are there timeless issues that are also explored, whether it's the Circe book or something else?
Right. So I think literature is timely and timeless at the same time. So, you know, there's Circe with, an epic odyssey. At the same time, there are relationships in that. There's power, there's war, there's gender roles. Nature and the environment throughout time are important issues, but right now it's a different issue than maybe it was 100 years ago, or maybe there's just a nuance to it. There's definitely a change in how we're looking at race, which has been a long time timeless issue, but there's a voice now who's looking at it differently and that we want to pay attention to. So there are definitely themes, and as there are in literature, that will, we hope, enrich our lives and raise our discourse.
10 Evenings, of course, runs in tandem with other arts and lectures programming, News and Noted, for example.
Right. So a few years ago, we expanded our series, and we now have 5, one of which we call New and Noted. And that brings authors who are touring with a new book. So we are thrilled to welcome Pittsburgher Stephen Chbosky back this fall with his long-awaited book, Since Perks of Being a Wallflower, called Imaginary Friend, which I just heard made a most scary books of all time list for Kirkus. So get ready. And we also have food writer Jeff Gordonier coming soon. We have Anne Enright, not announced yet, coming in the spring. So it's thrilling to be on book tour. They are energized. They are excited to be sharing their new book.
And, of course, you mentioned Jeff Gordonier, Book Hungry. It'll be in conversation with Pittsburgh chef Sonia Finn and also Post-Gazette food writer Dan Gigler.
It's going to be great. He travels the world learning about food, and to have two food stars from our own city talking to him, who he knows, because our food stars are, you know, really on the national playing field. So it's going to be very exciting.
For those who haven't attended an event, can you tell us what the evening is like? Is it a formal presentation, a reading, Q&A? Does it vary from writer to writer?
For the most part, great question. For the most part, we want anyone who hasn't attended to know that they are welcome, and that while 80% of our audience are subscribers, we always have single tickets, and we also ask our subscribers if they aren't coming to turn back their seats, because they also value that opportunity for someone new. So even if we're sold out, call us day of. We often have a seat for you. The author is asked to give a 45-minute talk. They've asked not to do a reading, so while I love to be read to, and I've heard authors read, this is very different, and some authors have told me this is the first time they've given a talk. And then we ask them to be themselves. So some people might read, some people might be more conversational, some have more notes than others, but we get their authentic self, and I think we get their authentic self because our audience is so warm and welcoming and puts them at ease.
How do you decide which author fits in which set of programming, whether it's New and Noted or the 10 Evenings?
So 10 Evenings started with a strong literary bent, and when I came, I decided to experiment with taking us back to those roots. So as you'll see on this list, lots of Pulitzer Prize winners, National Book Award winners, critics' circles. So this is where we're really reaching for that critical acclaim literary strength. New and Noted, sometimes we bring authors that could be on 10 Evenings there, but it's where we can play. So we had James Patterson recently. We've had Lydia Bastianich. We can have food writers, and we can have thrillers. We've had Louise Penny. So all genres are welcome, and it's really fun and exciting. Again, we hold our standards high and are proud of every author we bring in. One isn't better than the other. It's just different, and it helps our audience understand what they'll expect.
Stephanie Flom, Executive Director of Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures, is our guest on The Confluence. So thousands of patrons have attended the presentations, the talks by renowned writers, but their visits go beyond the presentation. You involve schools and students. How so?
We're really proud to share the resource of these incredible authors with the community in meaningful ways. And one way we do that is to take them to schools. So at least 4 of the authors each year are taken to a public school in the area, often an underserved public school. With our relationships with the teachers, we get them copies of the books ahead of time. Those dedicated teachers are willing to teach the books, develop questions with their students so that when they come for a Q&A, it's really meaningful. We also have partnerships with independent schools and the universities, so they often receive a visit as well. And we're told by all of them that those meetings of those authors are life-changing to the students.
the messages and the writing come alive for the kids, I imagine.
They do. I mean, someone just said recently, I never met an author growing up. And the teachers set the scene that there are people who are writing now. And a lot of the students consider themselves writers. And that's really thrilling when they ask, you know, high school students are asking questions about writing practice to an author. And we take our Words and Pictures authors to elementary schools. So 6 authors will go to an elementary school this year, and we make tickets available. We always have $10 student tickets. If anyone reaches out to us and they are willing to bring a group who's prepared, we will get them books, we will get them transportation, and we will get them seats. And it's an important part of our job, and we take it very seriously. And again, we want to reward those teachers who are willing to work extra hard.
Stephanie, how can you tell when a lecture's been successful? Right after the show? Eavesdropping on people's conversations afterwards? What?
There's an energy, you know, and that energy can be very different and still be successful. So sometimes there's just quiet awe. Sometimes there's laughter there. Sometimes there are challenging ideas and people are heated in the lobby. Sometimes people aren't moving from their seats. That, like I said, that moment where they just get up and start talking to the people around them and don't want to stop talking because they're processing and what they just heard. And on Tuesday mornings, the staff and I gather and we share our observations and our eavesdroppings and the comments that we hear that night, as well as the feedback we might receive later. But it's really that night.
So we got it with that one.
Yeah, exactly. We get that feeling often that, wow. I also love, and this happens practically after every lecture, that people are saying, this was the best one ever. And it's really like that love the one you're with, you know? Mm. So it's like, yes, you nailed it, and you've erased memory of every other incredible author for that moment.
High bar for the next one, though.
Yes, best one ever. Yep.
Stephanie Flom is the Executive Director of Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures. Stephanie, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The next author, Jeff Gordonier, is in-house on Thursday. The new 10-evening season begins September 23rd. We'll have a link to the full Arts and Lectures program schedule on our website, wesa.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Earlier this week, federal prosecutors announced they intend to seek the death penalty against the man accused of killing 11 Jewish worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue last year. However, 2 congregations say they disagree with prosecutors. While capital punishment clashes with the beliefs of some, others say they don't want to be exposed to a trial. And Allegheny County Council rejected a measure this week to create a civilian police review board. Some members say the bill was incomplete, but activists in favor of a review board say they will continue to push for one. Find more top stories on our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. All across the country, students are returning to school, and in Pittsburgh, that includes youth housed in the Allegheny County Jail. The jail runs a full high school for juveniles charged as adults. And 90.5 WESA's Only Herring reports, the students say it gives them hope, even behind bars.
An officer stands in the corner of a small classroom, and a red tape barrier separates students from the teacher's desk. But otherwise, this is a standard classroom with desks and a whiteboard. There are murals in the hallway, including one of the class mascot, a phoenix. Principal Jay Moser tells the students that in all the important ways, the academic institute at the Allegheny County Jail is like any other high school.
In this part of the building, you are a student. You'll be treated like a student, you'll be expected to act like a student, and you will be a student.
There are about a dozen juveniles currently enrolled at the school. They wear tan uniforms and listen attentively as Moser welcomes them to a new year.
When you're in school and you're learning, you have control. I can participate, I can listen, I can read, I can write. I have control in a place that gives you very little control.
The students are in jail because they're being tried as adults for the most serious crimes, like murder, rape, and robbery. Pennsylvania law requires jails and prisons to educate minors consistent with state standards. Some jails tutor students in their cells or have them do worksheets. But in Allegheny County, the jail's 9 teachers see their students in separate classrooms. The county does not allow incarcerated juveniles to share their last name. 16-year-old Christian has been in jail for about a year. He says going to school is freeing in a way.
It makes me feel like I'm not in jail. I actually feel like I'm outside instead of being in jail. It takes away all the, you know, the bars and all that.
Christian says he didn't used to like school at all, but now he finds it more exciting and works harder. He says his teachers are a big part of that.
Teachers, they really talk to me and really understand where I'm coming from. Even though they didn't know, they didn't come where I came from. There's no criticism here. That's my favorite thing about it.
Yeah, so we'll circle back here. Go put yours up on the board, please.
Christine Audenreath has taught at the jail for 9 years. On the first day of school, she asks the 5 students in her English class to write some facts about themselves to share with their classmates. It's a school rule not to talk about criminal cases. But Audenreath says reading literature and writing poetry can compel students to confront their pasts.
That always brings out a lot of emotions. So, yes, the students are very forthcoming and it's wonderful. They're very honest. They're very raw.
Despite those histories, Audenreath says the school has a good learning environment compared to other places she's taught.
There are disciplinary issues, and sometimes of a different magnitude or, you know, a different type. But for the most part, I think these students are even better behaved.
16-year-old Chad says school is more engaging at the jail, but his case is never far from his mind.
I want all this stuff I do here, just my judge to see and show him, like, I'm not trying to be in jail no more for me. Hopefully it helps. That way I can get back into the real world.
Chad and other students have dreams of going to college, and they say school motivates them to stay out of trouble once they're released. But 2 in 5 will end up in juvenile detention or prison when they leave the jail. Others age out to the jail's adult population. Principal Moser acknowledges the students arrive with more baggage than you might find in other classrooms.
Trauma, emotional issues, struggles in school, and then we try to piece together this great thing that we do, and we do it really well. And then hope that's enough.
Students who complete 12th grade here can get diplomas, but many will leave before then. So Moser says the school takes it day by day. Anlie Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A majority of House Democrats support beginning an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. But Democrats from moderate districts have been cautious, including Congressman Connor Lamb. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins explores how the issue is playing with the activists who helped elect Lamb.
All Lynn Hughes wanted was a representative who would be a check on President Trump.
I didn't care too much about policy, which is horrible, but I understood that I was not going to get someone that I agreed with 100% of the time because of the district that we were in.
Hughes lives in Mount Lebanon. Back in 2018, she was phone banking and knocking doors for Connor Lamb. Those efforts helped him narrowly win his special election in a district that voted for President Trump by a wide margin. Now that district maps have been redrawn, Lamb represents Beaver County, which Trump carried by double digits, as well as Pittsburgh suburbs.
It is plain to see that Trump meets the bar for impeachment. And I am also old enough to remember when Connor ran in that special election and he told everyone to wait for the Mueller report, to trust in the Mueller report to come out. Well, the Mueller report came out, and then Congressman Lamb was silent for about a month.
Because of the political makeup of his district, Lamb's impeachment approach has drawn national attention. When the Mueller report came out in April, many lawmakers called for impeachment based on its findings. Others said an inquiry should begin because the White House ignores subpoenas from House oversight committees. In May, Lamb said that no one is above the law, but that he believed the disputes would be resolved in court. That answer hasn't satisfied everyone.
All right, do we have questions? I think
more than 100 people came to a town hall Lamb hosted in Allison Park during the August recess. Mount Lebanon resident Nita Fandre strongly criticized the president while wearing an impeach Trump T-shirt.
He is a white supremacist, and he has racially divided this country. What I'm asking you is whether you will join with your 127 colleagues in the House of Representatives and support an impeachment inquiry.
Along with gun control, impeachment was the major topic of the night, and Lamb echoed what he said in the past.
I'm not convinced now, nor have I been, that we have met the bar for impeachment. I think that's an extremely high bar, but I am continuing to follow these investigations as much as I can.
But impeachment is not very important to other supporters. Darren Kelly is president of the Allegheny-Fayette Central Labor Council and represents union members whose grassroots activity was key to Lamb's win. Kelly says, sure, some of his union members want to talk about impeachment, but the big issues are infrastructure, the opioid epidemic, and trade.
And we've talked to hundreds. You know, we go to the same town halls, we sit with a lot of people and hear what our members have to say, and it's been consistent.
But others say the issue is not that clear-cut. O'Hara Township resident Stacey Vernalis leads a progressive activist group in the district. She knows that there's frustration among Lamb supporters.
I mean, I have to scrape them off the ceiling.
Vernalis herself says she swings between being frustrated and recognizing that when you have a district like Lamb's, you have to be pragmatic. After all, moderates like Lamb helped ensure a Democratic majority in the House.
I say keep the eye on the ball. You know, we need an electoral victory in 2020. We got the best guy we could possibly get who could win in the office.
But Lynn Hughes, who wanted to see Lamb elected solely to be a check on Trump, doesn't buy that argument.
I don't think it's the job of the grassroots to just fall lockstep in line with the Democratic Party.
Hughes says she won't work as hard for Lamb in 2020 and will volunteer for the Democratic presidential nominee instead.
I don't know how Congressman Lamb wins without the grassroots in 2020, but it would be interesting to see him try to win that.
She says if Lamb doesn't win, maybe he deserves to lose. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The current opioid epidemic is not the first drug epidemic in the U.S. And while today's drug crisis is certainly the deadliest in American history, there were many casualties associated with previous epidemics. Take, for example, the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s and 90s, which especially affected Black and Latinx communities. 90.5 WESA Sarah Bowden talks with drug historian David Herzberg about what we've learned from the past and how we can apply the lessons of today to future epidemics.
The response to crack cocaine was calamitous. I mean, it was a catastrophe. The idea being that, well, these are just a bunch of criminal animals and we need to lock them up. We're still paying for it today. And when you compare it to the more recent crisis, there has been a very strong effort to have a sympathetic understanding of people who use opioids, to think about them as people who belong to us and who deserve protection and deserve treatment.
National data and local data does show that the fatality rate is finally declining. Why are we thankfully experiencing fewer deaths in relation to this drug epidemic?
Number one is the spread of harm reduction tactics, and most importantly, the only evidence-based treatment that we know of for opioid addiction that is shown to dramatically reduce overdose deaths, which is providing a long-acting opioid to people who have addiction. And so you can do things like hold down your job and come through with your family commitments without having to think every 3 or 4 hours, where will I purchase the next bit of supply? So the second thing is that there is a pattern to drug crises, which is that after a certain amount of time where the people most likely to become addicted, they're often young people just coming of age, there's been enough experience of witnessing harms and tragedy that urge to experiment with, to use drugs, shifts in a different direction. That, you know, someone coming of age today may say, I don't want to use opioids. I've seen the kind of death and destruction that can come with that, and I'm going to go in a different direction with that part of my life.
But what about other drug epidemics throughout U.S. history? How does what we're seeing now compare to the past?
What's often happened is that when there's a pharmaceutical drug crisis, there's reasonably decent policy developed to try to address it and to try to prevent new ones. And when I say reasonably decent, what I mean is there's robust regulation of the large companies that are selling those drugs done in the name of protecting the consumers who it's assumed are going to continue to use the drugs. Let's say, for example, there's a big crisis surrounding Valium use in the 1960s, 1970s. Valium is a tranquilizer, an anti-anxiety medication. Lots of people having problems. It was tops on the list of reasons people showed up in emergency rooms, and overdose deaths were really high. And the response wasn't, we're going to make it illegal to use Valium. The response was, we're going to clamp down on the kinds of behaviors by big actors, Roche Pharmaceuticals, physicians groups, to try to change the market so that it stopped delivering drugs in an unsafe way to those consumers who, it was assumed, they still need this drug. People still have anxiety. They still have insomnia. They still have these problems. And as a result, use did go down, but it didn't go away, and it became a lot safer.
Looking towards the future, how do you think society is going to be responding to whatever comes next?
Stimulant use and tranquilizer use, like benzodiazepines, like Valium and Xanax, those have actually been shooting up since the 90s, right alongside OxyContin for a bunch of different reasons. But the other thing that the future holds that is even, that maybe even more worrisome, is how will we respond if there's a new crisis involving people that all of the journalist class and the politician class don't see as part of us? And so everything we've learned from the opioid crisis about thinking about addiction, about caring for people with addiction, seeing them as humans deserving of dignity, that we'll toss that out the window and see this as, well, this is a very different kind of problem. There'll be some new name for the drug and say, well, this is a new horrifying thing that's not like that other one, and we just need to arrest everyone. I think a lot about how do we translate the things we've been saying about these suburban white kids using opioids, how do we translate that so that it applies to everyone who uses drugs?
That was historian David Herzberg of the University of Buffalo, State University of New York, speaking with WESA health reporter Sarah Bowden. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Looking for something to do in Pittsburgh this weekend? In the days and weeks ahead? Maybe the years ahead? Rosalind Culkin is the author of 100 Things to Do in Pittsburgh Before You Die, second edition. Welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Were there personal favorites, maybe some submitted by friends, colleagues, or readers of The Incline, where you also serve as an editor, that's contributed to these 100 things?
Yes, definitely. I started by asking family and friends for recommendations, and anyone on Facebook and Twitter. One of my family favorites is Falling Water, and I try not to choose favorites because I love everything in this book, but Falling Water does make the top of the list for me.
All right. So people, friends, colleagues, they made suggestions, but you had the final say. Nah, disagree with you?
Yes. And it was very hard to be the judge of the list. So I started with this giant Google Doc and just whittled down the list. And there were many that ended up on the chopping block. So maybe for the third edition, I'll be able to include some of those.
Have you experienced all 100 things? You are a native, aren't you?
Well, I grew up in Westmoreland County, so I guess there is debate over whether that means I'm a Pittsburgh native, but I like to think so. And now I live in the Strip District, so many of these things I'm lucky to have in my backyard. And I have done almost all 100. I did a lot of the research for the book during the winter time, so there were some things that weren't happening in the winter. And also, I've tried to go to a movie in the park for years, and every time I try, it rains. So maybe I'll have to get a sunny day, but I've done almost all 100.
All right. We'll check back in with you after this winter to see if you've accomplished that. One of the great things about hosting visitors is to take them to one of these sites and re-experience them for ourselves. Which is your favorite to take an out-of-towner to?
Oh, goodness, there are so many.
Now, I say,
well, I'm going to say, and not just because I work at a news website called The Incline, but I'm going to say The Incline, the ones on Mount Washington, because to me, they're so special. They're so unique. They're so classic Pittsburgh. And not only do you get the thrill of going up Mount Washington, but then once you're at the top, you can stop by the museum and learn a little bit about Pittsburgh history. And also the view, and stopping at DeFiori's for ice cream. So you've got it all.
Okay. Says things to do in Pittsburgh before you die. How big of an area, though, did you include with Pittsburgh, because you've already mentioned Falling Water.
Yeah, so I define Pittsburgh as the region for the purposes of this book, and I did try to stay in the city as much as possible and highlight as many city neighborhoods as I could. But there are just so many gems in our region that had to be included that don't fall within the city limits. So the furthest I think I went was the Laurel Highlands on that end, and then on the western southwestern end, I went down to Avella for Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, mm-hmm. which is one of my personal favorites also.
Right. Well, so we have the Flight 93 Memorial. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get you on a technicality here.
Oh, no.
Yes, I am. I think the farthest away is the Gap Trail. Because it ends in Cumberland, Maryland.
Yes, good point. Good point. The beginning might be close, but yes, if you take that whole trail, you're going to be way out of Pittsburgh by the end. And that is one thing I've never done. I've never gone all the way to Cumberland. I've done little patches of the trail, but not the whole thing. So that's on my list.
But still, that is recommendable.
Yes, for sure.
What would you say the newest must-do is?
Oh, the newest. Well,
or one of the newer ones that come to mind.
So it's funny because, as soon as I wrote this book, I knew things would change, as is, happening in Pittsburgh. Sure. So many things are changing. One of those things is Scare House. I wrote about Scare House in here, and they have some big new plans.
Right.
So I'll hopefully be able to update that. And then another new one would be a restaurant that I love, Apteka, which is up by Children's Hospital. It is an Eastern European restaurant with some of my favorite pierogies in town.
Oh, you better watch it. You're just asking for a fight, a verbal battle over where the best pierogies
it's
are.
It's true. There's so many good ones. They're one of my favorite, but I've got a few.
And so those are some of the newer ones. And the oldest one, I think, is sort of obvious.
Meadowcroft, for sure.
Yeah, the Rock Shelter, 16,000 years ago, the inhabitants.
Right? Yes, that is absolutely fascinating. I highly recommend that for anyone who hasn't done it. And do it before the summer ends, before their season ends.
Yeah, it is a fascinating place, and it's not that far away in the Avella area. So you organize the things by different categories to make it easy. Food and drink, art and culture, music and entertainment, sports and recreation, shopping and fashion. But nearly half, 43 of them, are in the art and culture category.
Yeah.
Is that because art and culture is such a broad category itself, or there are just lots of great things to do within art and culture in the Pittsburgh region?
I think it's a little of both. There are so many arts and culture things to do here. And yes, it is a broad catch-all category. So if something doesn't fit quite tidily into the other spots, it fits well there. And also probably I'm a huge fan of the arts. So for me, this was a place that I really wanted to explore and encourage people to get out and explore as well.
Give us the range of the art and culture, if you will, because some are obvious. Carnegie Museum of Art, Andy Warhol Museum, those immediately would come to mind when we think of art. But what would you think? Oh, yeah, that would be part of our culture. And maybe people wouldn't think about it being in that category you created.
Well, I think one that we've probably all walked past, at least if anyone's gone to a Steelers game or been at Carnegie Science Center on the North Shore, is the Mr. Rogers sculpture. And now I know it's controversial. Not everyone really loves that sculpture, but I happen to think it's absolutely beautiful. Not just as a place to get a nice photo, but seeing the idea of Mr. Rogers watching over Pittsburgh as a piece of art is really quite touching, in my opinion.
Yeah, you don't have to like the sculpture, per se. But you have to like the inspiration for that sculpture.
Exactly. And how he's just sort of perched there as if kind of just watching over the town. It's really quite sweet.
Mm-hmm. Is there sort of a hidden gem within the art culture area, whether it's, although it's getting more and more popular, Randyland, maybe, for example?
Yes. I visited Randyland a couple weeks ago, and I have to tell you, I was shocked by how packed it was. I knew Randyland has gotten a lot of national and international attention, but it was just swarmed, which is wonderful. You had kids playing, you had families taking pictures, just exploring. So it's a hidden gem, but maybe not quite so hidden anymore.
So more people are discovering, but for those who haven't, give us just a little description what they'll find at Randyland.
So Randyland is a house on the north side that you can't miss because it is in bright, bright technicolors. And Randy, the artist there, Randy Gilson, has created this beautiful escape where he reinvents, mannequins, old rocking chairs, anything you could really imagine, painted in bright neon colors, and it's a real paradise.
Our guest on The Confluence is Rosalind Culgan, author of 100 Things to Do in Pittsburgh Before You Die, and yes, there is a bucket on the cover of the book. Many of your list are very well known, Steelers game, waving a terrible towel, a must, Phipps, the nationality rooms, for example. But give us another one that is maybe less than discovered than those obvious ones.
Yeah, so it is also getting a little more attention recently, but still a hidden gem. It's called the Bayernhof Museum. Have you been?
No, I have not, and well, I am
a
native.
You must. It is a music machine museum, and it's out near O'Hara Township. It's basically a mansion that is full of old music machines, and it is truly one of a kind. The tours are fantastic. Make sure you book one in advance, and you will learn so much. And just, it's full of sort of these odd old music machines. It's a real treat.
You've have itineraries by season. Is that because they're not necessarily year-round, or they're better experienced during a particular season?
Yeah, some of both. So some of the places are not year-round. Like, for example, we talked about Meadowcroft having a season. But some of the places, and this one was hard for me because we've talked about Falling Water, but seeing it in the fall
is
stunning.
That's my favorite time.
Yes, but also—
May is the latest for me. Fall is the preferred. Summer is still nice, but still.
Yes, agreed. But also in the summertime, you have the beautiful flowers blooming. So it's a toss-up, but I did try to slot things into categories where it would be the best opportunity for visitors.
Well, we're not far away from fall. Give us a couple ideas on your fall itinerary.
Yeah, so, well, one of them, which, and I have not done this one yet, but Kennywood's fall activities have always been on my list. We've talked about Scare House as well. Of course, that's classic for the fall. And then I also talked about going to the 9/11 memorial. We talked a little bit about that one, too. Obviously, that's quite powerful to visit any time, but I think visiting around September 11th is particularly meaningful.
Give us one thing that didn't make the cut, didn't make the 100, because you probably just said, no, I can't have 101, 103,
right.
105, that you would have liked to include. Just one.
There are many, but one will be the Allegheny Observatory. It's really wonderful to get out and look at the stars, and also the star parties, which
up at Riverview Park.
Yep. I think those are really special, and there just wasn't space, but maybe next time. I did give a shout out to Carnegie Science Center's Skywatch. So I wanted to include astronomy somewhere, but I wish I could have included astronomy a little bit more.
What have you heard so far from readers? I mean, Pittsburghers, we have sort of friendly arguments about everything. Best pizza to the best neighborhood. Has your list of 100 generated any passionate debate about these? This should be included. Why didn't you include that?
Not too much. My favorite thing, though, is when I go to a book signing and you meet someone who's lived here forever, they kind of pick up the book and they say, oh, I've done everything. And then I'll say, oh, but have you done this? And they're like, no, I haven't done that. And I'll say, hey, well, have you done this? No, I've never heard of that. So that makes me feel really happy that people think they've done everything and I'm showing them something new.
Rosalind, if someone, a non-native, and we've declared that you are, even though you grew up in Westmoreland County, checks off all 100 things to do, will that make them a true Pittsburgher?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think you're a true Pittsburgher when you believe you're a true Pittsburgher. Maybe that sounds a little hokey, but that's the way I feel. If you feel some love for Pittsburgh, it means you're a Pittsburgher. But I think if you do all these 100 things, you'll be a Pittsburgh expert for sure, because there's just so much to learn here. And really, I think there's a lot of pride in Pittsburgh for these cultural gems.
So are you compiling ideas for edition 3?
I'll take them. I would be happy to take ideas if anyone's got them. And even if they have a spirited debate, I'll take it too.
Rosalind Culligan is the author of 100 Things to Do in Pittsburgh Before You Die, the second edition. Thanks, Rosalind.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. No Confluence on Labor Day, but Tuesday on the program, does Pittsburgh have a brand? Plus, community gardens are popping up all over, thanks largely to Grow Pittsburgh, that for 10 years has fostered the idea that everyone should have the opportunity to grow their own healthy food. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, the editor and producer of The Confluence, is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good holiday weekend of good news.